Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll have several different interviews for you today. My guest for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show is sometimes described as one of an extraordinarily rare species, a woman who owns a successful software development company. Her name is Anna Murray, and actually she and her husband, Chris Moscovitis, own TMG eMedia. And Anna Murray is someone who can speak to the world of technology from a very rich personal perspective and expertise, and a nationally recognized technology consultant, the author of the critically acclaimed The Complete Software Project Manager. And we're going to be talking with her about a couple of different issues that involve technology, and in particular, the presence of women in the technology sector, something that once upon a time was extremely rare, maybe not quite as rare as it once was. And we'll touch on some other issues as well. Anna P. Murray, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us, first of all, your own story of becoming so interested in the technology sector. At what point in your life did that occur, and for any particular reason?
I fell into it a little bit by accident. I was a young person. At first I was a teacher, and then I was fascinated by, at that time, CD-ROMs were on the cover of Time magazine, and I made the transition to an educational software publisher, and that was right at the dawn of the internet. And the educational software publisher sort of said, you know, this internet thing, we kind of don't think it's going anywhere. And at that moment, I took the initiative and I grabbed a bunch of programmers and we started an early stage web company in 1996.
I remember a few years ago, I mean, and by a few, I mean probably 20 years ago, maybe longer than that, doing an interesting interview with a couple of local professors around the whole issue of why there were so few women who were going into the field of computer science. And one of them was in the field, and the other was a psychology professor at the same local university. And they actually did some kind of study on this. And I remember having this very intriguing conversation with them and getting from them a few theories which they had developed on why it was that, at least at that point in time, so few women were going into the field of computer science, and of those few that would enter the field, how many of them would then leave the field for various reasons. First of all, what is your perspective in terms of how much that has changed over the years? How rare was it when you first entered the field, and how rare is it today?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think if you take an even greater historical perspective, it kind of starts to surface some of the issues. So back in the 1950s and 60s, women were the you called them computer operators. They were the ones doing the punch card and the code. And I think that's because, I mean, really, you know, it was thought of as more of a clerical job. Oh, women can operate that machine. And then as it became much more prominent and sexy and higher paid, women exited the profession. So then what happened is probably in the 80s and 90s, we were very hopeful because we saw an uptick of women in engineering fields. At that point, most computer science was located in electrical engineering departments. But then things kind of took a left turn. And over the last decade or so, the percentage of women in computer science departments has dropped. So there's been a waxing and waning over, you know, the course of the last half century of women in these technical fields. So I think another perspective is that, you know, we see certain professions as a society as male or female, and that shifts over time. And it usually has to do with power and compensation. So bank teller used to be a male job, right? It was an authoritative job. It dealt with money. It dealt with math. And now, and then bank teller became a female job. It was already beginning to lose prestige. And now, well, now you can hardly find a bank teller. But I think it illustrates the point that our perspective towards professions and how powerful they are and how highly compensated they are really affects the gender balance.
I know that one of the theories that they also presented at the time, and perhaps this was especially true way back then, is the fact that the perception might be that to be a computer science major or in the field of computer science was likely to be a rather impersonal experience, maybe in large measure a solitary kind of experience or exercise that might be a real turnoff or a point of discouragement for a woman who might be seeking something in which contact with others, meaningful exchange and collaboration is really important. So their thought was that maybe to some extent women were making assumptions about what this field was like, and maybe at the time, maybe some of those assumptions were more true than they are today. I'm not sure, but what would you say to that notion of being in the technology sector as being sometimes kind of a solitary exercise? I suspect that in point of fact, in actuality, it really isn't that at all.
Well, you know, firstly, I think there are plenty of women introverts. You know, I think that there's a societal perspective that women are the connectors and the relators, and, you know, who knows what's inborn and what's created by society. You know, the second thing is that we do know that just by changing the nomenclature in a course in a course catalog, that you can affect the number of women who enter that class. So, for example, young men are more attracted to, let's say, the equipment side of things, like the Wi-Fi triple jammer, and we're going to, you know, build servers or whatever we're going to do. And women tend to be more attracted to outcomes. So, let's say a course catalog title that implied, you know, we're going to address vaccinations in the developing world through data science. Now, that tends to be more attractive to the female student. So there, I agree that there is a component of how we perceive a class or a profession. I would also suggest that there are there's a broad mixture of temperaments and personalities among both men and women. But that we do know, that women will be more attracted to classes and to a profession based on sort of the outcome or the purpose of not just like data science, not so attractive to females. Data science in pursuit of solving hunger in the developing world, more attractive.
Fascinating. So for you, being in this field, what has it meant to you? What have been the greatest frustrations? What have been the points of greatest satisfaction?
Well, I'll start with the satisfaction. You know, first of all, it was tremendous fun to be in the cutting edge of a field that was just developing. I mean, to feel like you were building people's first websites and sort of inventing what the thing is, that was super fun. And also, you know, although I didn't really understand this aspect of it when I was much younger, but owning a company and paying people salaries and giving them health care and paying for their children to go to college and helping them, you know, buy a house, that was a hidden benefit that I had no idea existed when I was 27 years of age. You know, I mean, that feels very, very good. On the downside, and then, of course, temperamentally, if you're wired to run your own company, you know, a lot of the stresses and how you make payroll and stuff, they just become part of the background noise. So But it, being a woman in this field has been, it has shown me a side of human nature that I kind of thought we'd solved, to be honest with you. You know, when I was young and I was educated in the 80s by hopeful people who were baby boomers and, you know, taught me about feminism and that the world had changed from, you know, the 40s and 50s. So, you know, when I entered the business world, I thought they had changed. And, you know, the common things that women report, like being interrupted. Women are interrupted 3 times more often than men. And, you know, my husband and I are now in business together, and I would say something in a board meeting and, you know, be ignored or shouted down, and 10 minutes later he would say the same thing, and eureka, it's brilliant. You know, those kinds of things still really exist. So that part of it was a little depressing.
Hmm. I did want to ask you about the collaboration between you and your husband, Chris Moscovitis, who, in a sense, have put a company together or put two different companies together, and what this collaboration has been like for the two of you.
You know, Chris and I get along really well in the professional sense. We actually work together professionally. I can see a lot of couples where this wouldn't work. In fact, I've certainly been in relationships, different relationships where I could never work with a person. For us, it's fun. You know, we approach business in the same way. He has a level of brilliance that is different from mine and very, very complementary. So it's a well-coordinated dance. Sometimes we work on the same projects together. Sometimes we work on different projects together. And for us, it's really been a joy.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anna P. Murray. And she and her husband have TMG eMedia, a technology management group. And they do consulting on various matters related to technology. When you are working with clients, typically, what are sort of the maybe misassumptions or misunderstandings that sometimes drive the perspectives of your clients? I mean, what are the kind of new perspectives that you need your clients to adopt when it comes to understanding the role of technology and perhaps what they need to be doing differently in order to serve their businesses more effectively?
Well, you know, I think a lot of clients, I would like to see a shift in at the business level, at the strategic business level, the thinking about technology. So, for example, let's say you were a CEO or COO, president, manager, director, whatever you want to say, of a company, and you have to deal with your finances, and you have some budgetary issues to accomplish, you're going to be expected to read a P&L. And you probably took an accounting class, and you kind of have your head around the basics of accounting on a cash basis, accounting on accrual basis. These may sound like arcane terms, but a lot of CEOs are perfectly comfortable dealing with that. And yet I find when it comes to dealing with, you know, I don't know, we need to scale the database or we need to migrate data, whatever, you know, a lot of CEOs, directors, managers kind of look at you like, oh, don't talk to me in that crazy language. You know, so they go from being perfectly capable of dealing with other arcane matters to like, I don't know how to make birth, no babies, you know, in this area. And it's actually a little shameful. You know, I think we need to sort of grow up as business people and realize that in 2019, you know, it's your responsibility. Get a book for dummies. You know, I don't know what it takes, but it's your responsibility to get it. And when I go into a client, it's my responsibility to help them get it. Because, you know, being heard is not the job in the real world. Being heard is not the job of the listener. It's the job of the communicator. So you got to figure out a way to get the message across. You have to be an excellent teacher. I often say you have to be an excellent Secretary of State, because often technology projects involve multiple departments, none of whom report to each other. So you need that coordination. So it's about understanding that we need to understand technology and then coordinating the effort in a way that's a little like, you know, sometimes negotiating peace in the world.
Hmm. How about the whole matter of cybersecurity? I wonder, first of all, in general, do your clients tend to not take this matter seriously enough, or is it a point of clients maybe being overly concerned, maybe paranoid about threats that aren't actually likely to be meaningful threats to what they do? I mean, by and large, where do your clients tend to fall in that continuum, and what are the kinds of guiding principles that you think can be helpful?
Oh, I don't think they're overly concerned. I'll say that. I mean, with one notable exception, which is a multinational that I work with, I think that most clients are, I always say, especially when my husband, who's written a book on cybersecurity, gets very frustrated, I always say, look, Chris, this is like cigarettes and seatbelts in 1979. You know, it's like, my granddaddy smoked till he was 97. Fine. You know, I don't want to, the seatbelts nonsense. So that's where we are with cybersecurity. I mean, really seriously, even companies that you would think you would not think were should be out to lunch on this really are. So, you know, it's really, we're really at the beginning. We're very much at the beginning, which is, you know, is your data encrypted? Do you have firewalls? Do you have a cybersecurity program? Do you have a recovery program if your data becomes corrupted? Do you have a PR management program? I mean, people, and part of the reason, as you can see as I'm going through the list, part of the reason that people are in avoidance is that it's overwhelming. And it is overwhelming, and it's very discouraging because, you know, it's not a question, which is what all us cybersecurity folks who deal in this world say, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Well, if I'm going to fail anyway, you know, but the truth is you need to have some, you need to take step one so you can take step two, because even if we are fighting a losing battle, which we may be, you will be the one that will have the PR plan in place and the recovery plan in place. And also, you know, there's what I like to call the pain in the ass factor. If your company is more of a pain in the ass to break into than another company, then you fall down on the list in terms of being a target.
Mm. So the level of vulnerability really matters. I mean, it's probably not possible to make any company completely impregnable, but if your company is more difficult to penetrate by an outside threat, likely they will move on to a more inviting target to which they can gain easier access.
Yes, that's human nature, and that will always be true. But companies do really have to. I mean, there will be, you know, so why, okay, why are we at seatbelts and cigarettes in 1979 when it comes to cybersecurity? The reason is people aren't having to pay for it. But that will change, you know, as individuals, our business lives and our individual lives are blended. So your data, your email, exists because you exist in the world as a business person, because you go to the doctor, because you pay taxes. All of that data exists because you have to interact in the world. It is extremely painful to have your identity stolen, because if someone, for example, is able to, let's put together a scenario that involves social engineering and a little hacking. You know, somebody gets your email address and somebody gets your password through a hacking attempt. Okay, now they go to, well, we all know that Facebook has been releasing data like, you know, in a cascade. So now they know your mother's maiden name, they know your dog's name, all of these security questions. Now you're building a scenario where someone can hack into your bank account. And now they take a dollar, they take $2. Nobody knows this is next time they take $10,000. Well, in the banking, in this world, the electronic banking world, different from the world of checks, you only have 90 days to report that. So if you go beyond that 90 days, And some of us aren't so great, you know, about checking on things constantly. Maybe it's a minor account, maybe it's a savings account. You know, in the habit of checking on that, that the bank doesn't have to replace that money. Now that hurts. And what I just narrated is a real world scenario that we are acquainted with through the work that we do. So now people are hopping mad. Now we have a class action suit. So my point is that the reason that people aren't taking these things seriously is that nobody's having to pay the consequence of not paying attention to cybersecurity.
How much do you find that a challenge is in the work that you do, the fact that we're often talking about highly technical matters, I mean, by their very nature, often involving nearly impregnable terminology, and for people who are experts in their own field, but not experts in technology, can it be difficult to, for instance, make the case for sweeping changes that one might make within your own company? What kind of a challenge is that for you?
I think it's one of the biggest challenges. In fact, if you don't have buy-in at the board level and at the, you know, the ownership management level, you're probably not going to get very far, because it really does involve, because, you know, what happens is the lower-level manager, a mid-level manager has authorized a certain, you know, technology or cybersecurity program. And then the CEO goes on a trip to Asia and wants to bring his insecure iPhone, and now the whole thing is going down in a pile. You know, you've got the person with the most access, or that, let's say, although finance people tend to be far more careful because they know they got to guard the money. But, you know, if you have a breach of the CEO's equipment, you got a real problem. And similarly, even if we're talking about just a major technology initiative, these things tend to be, as I said previously in the conversation, they tend to be very multi-departmental. So if you have, and they also, you know, change involves pain. Human beings don't like change. It's a normal part of the world. So unless you have guidance and leadership saying we're doing this, you know, generally these things don't happen, and they don't happen well. That, you know, it's unfortunate truth, but it is, in my 20-some years of doing this, without higher-level buy-in to whatever larger-scale technology initiative you're attempting, it generally doesn't go very well.
Hmm. Before I let you go, I want to circle back to our first topic, namely the presence of women in the field, and ask you about something called She Leads Tech, something that you are involved in that apparently exists to work on this particular issue. Can you say a word about that?
Absolutely. She Leads Tech is part of ISACA, which is a cybersecurity organization, and it is devoted to achieving gender balance of women in technology worldwide. And one of the issues we're working on right now has to do with retention, because I think, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, even if we get women into technology fields, they tend to erode. So you have this issue of women being, let's say, not attracted to technology fields, partly because representation isn't there. I mean, we gravitate towards people who look like us. We follow in the footsteps of someone we can identify with. Well, if you're facing a wall of people who don't look like you, the profession itself becomes maybe something that's not your favorite to pursue. And then once women are in the profession, we don't do a great job of offering the things that, I am going to use air quotes here, women need. In point of fact, this is a family problem. This is, raising children is a family problem. It's not a woman problem. However, in the real world, right now it is a woman problem. We know that women shoulder the vast majority of child-rearing responsibilities and homekeeping responsibilities. So in order to retain women, our professions need to offer the flexibility that role in the family requires. And typically male professions tend to be far more rigid in terms of face time, time off, you know, child care, flexible hours, work from home, and which is ironic because you would think technology would be one of the most adaptable to those circumstances.
Right, since technology is such a valuable tool to make that so much more workable than it once was.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. So I'm proud to be a part of She Leads Tech. It's a terrific organization, again, devoted to achieving gender balance for women in technology.
Very good. Anna P. Murray is the author of The Complete Software Project Manager, Mastering Technology from Planning to Launch and Beyond, published by Wiley. And if people want more information on what you do, where should they look?
You can go to our website, which is www.pmg-emedia.com. You can also look me up on Amazon, put a P in the middle of the name, Anna P. Murray, because it turns out there's a lot of Anna Murrays out there.
Very good. Anna P. Murray, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. This was fun.
Thanks so much.
It's 8:36. And part two of today's morning show here on WGTD will be coming up in just a moment. And for the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about some interesting innovations in the field of crime prevention and in the work of police across the country. We're going to be talking about an initiative called SPI, Strategies for Policing Innovation, and about some study that has been done in this by the nonprofit research organization CNA. Chip Coldren is the Managing Director of Justice Programs in CNA's Safety and Security Division, and he has been kind of leading the effort in exploring just what has been going on with this matter of SPI in various policing districts across the country. Mr. Coldren, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So tell us, first of all, what initiated this matter of strategies for policing innovation? What sort of issues were hoped to be addressed by starting this initiative?
Yes, so this initiative started about 10 years ago, and back then that was around 2009, which is just after the 2008 recession. And what we were observing is that in a number of communities across the country, policing services were being reduced. Budgets were being reduced, and the police force itself was getting smaller. At the same time, the work of policing was getting more complex, and public expectations of what the police would do were not diminishing. And so the federal government realized that the police needed to focus on being more efficient and more effective and learning how to do more with less. And so that was the genesis of the policing innovation work. They also... They felt at the time that the strategies being put in place to reduce crime and violence in this country were getting rather stale. They were seeing the same types of proposals and the same types of suppression-oriented approaches, you know, being offered up again and again and again. And they truly desired to inject some innovation in the way the police approach their public safety work.
One of the hallmarks, apparently, is... a new recognition of the significance of research, that research needs to go hand in hand with the work that police departments do and needs to be at the heart of many of the decisions they make about how they're going to do what they do. Tell us more about the kind of research that we are talking about, or the way in which research could be a valuable tool for a given police district.
Right. So, hand-in-hand with innovation is the need to adapt and the need to use science and information to learn better how to adapt to the dynamic nature of crime and the social order. So what research does is it helps police agencies, you know, working with a researcher, helps police agencies to identify and analyze the data that they need to look at in order to find new ways of doing things and be more effective. But maybe more importantly, once they try something new, they need to test and see if what they did that was new actually made a difference in the community. And the best way to do that is to conduct a research analysis that has a comparative aspect to it. So you have to compare your community to another community. You just can't look at the before and after of an intervention. You have to look at a place where this intervention was not tried and see if the results are different in the places that it was tried. Hmm. So, and the other interesting thing about research and this use of data is it actually makes the police more transparent. So it has a wonderful public education function in that people now learn more and see more, not only what police are doing, but they learn how they're doing it and why they're doing it and whether it's actually having an impact on public safety. And we can say with confidence that in the 57 communities that have undertaken SPI projects over the past 10 years, in most of them, the public safety impacts have been positive and very significant. Hmm.
I think one of the interesting things I noticed in the report that is about to be released to the public about what your study uncovered is that in some cases what we're talking about is the use of maybe research in an innovative way, but often then what ends up being kind of implemented is not any sort of groundbreaking technological breakthrough. In many cases, it's utilizing tools that have been with us for a long time. I'm thinking of the story of Philadelphia and of how they identified certain hotspots and then to those hotspots where crime was a big issue, trying to deploy foot patrols in more concerted fashion. I mean, in a sense, there's nothing sort of newfangled about that. That's very much sort of old-fashioned policing, but it's being implemented or directed in much more careful fashion because of this research component. Is that a fair summary of what's going on, for instance, in Philadelphia?
That is fair. I would add to that that in some cases, the source of the innovation is cleverly hidden, so to speak. So yes, there were foot patrols in Philadelphia that, you know, that proved to be more effective than other approaches to policing. But what's happening behind the scenes is that researchers and crime analysts and police officers themselves are changing the way that they access and use the information that's available to them. So there's been something of a movement in a lot of police agencies around the country to decentralize the crime analysis function. So the crime analysts no longer sit at headquarters, but they sit out at the district stations and they work more directly with police officers and detectives. So that's an innovation. That's an organizational innovation that's taken place in many police departments around the country. That doesn't get the, you know, the attention that the crime fighting does, so to speak.
Good point. I want to be sure before I have to let you go to give you a chance to talk thoroughly about the story of Chicago, since we're right up the road from Chicago, Illinois. And that's, of course, a major American city that has really been racked with very high violent crime rates. And it's good to hear about some of the concerted efforts in Chicago to try to bring some of these issues under better control. What can you tell us about the story of Chicago, Illinois?
I can tell you an awful lot. I can tell you firsthand because I'm a former resident of Chicago. And 20 years ago, I was on the ground floor introducing community policing to Chicago and conducting training sessions in local communities about community policing. And in those 20 years, Chicago has been a chronically, and parts of the city have been chronically extremely violent. And attempt after attempt after attempt by the police department to reduce and quell those pockets of violence have not been effective. In recent years, the Chicago Police Department has introduced the notion of strategic decision support centers. These are information and technology-driven centers that are located in the precinct houses that, again, bring the patrol officer and the detective much closer to the analyst and the information that they need to be effective in their deployment of resources. And in the communities, the first few communities where these support centers were created, communities like Austin and Englewood that, again, have traditionally been very violent communities, we are seeing dramatic reductions in violence and shootings in those communities. And research is suggesting that we can be confident that it was the introduction of these decision support centers that produced at least a fair amount of those reductions.
When will the report done by CNA be available for the public to peruse? And at that point, how can they track it down to take a look at it?
It's available right now. If they go to www.cna.org and scroll about halfway down that page, you'll find a link to the report. You can also go on Twitter to hashtag SPI, the number 10, and you'll find information there.
Very good. James Chip Coldren is Managing Director of Justice Programs in CNA's Safety and Security Division, and he had a very direct hand in the crafting of this report titled The Strategies for Policing Innovation Initiative, Reflecting on 10 Years of Innovation. Thank you, sir, for joining us on The Morning Show. Thank you for your good work.
Thank you, too, sir. Appreciate it.
And the time is 8:47 here on WGTD. And to finish out today's morning show, an interview from the Morning Show Archives, an interview from 2011. I've had on one previous occasion the great pleasure and honor of speaking with best-selling author Anne Brashears. On that occasion, talking about her book, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. She is responsible for other fine books, including The Last Summer of You and Me. But this time we talk about a marvelous new novel, which is called My Name is Memory, based upon the very intriguing notion that all of us come back to Earth again and again and again, many times over, but there are only a very tiny few of us who remember our previous lives. And this particular story revolves around a man who has the memory, this special capacity for remembering his previous lives on Earth. And through each of these lives, he seeks to reconnect with the woman that he loves, a woman with whom he has a very powerful connection. And I am so excited to be able to speak with Anne Brashears about this novel and the beautiful craftsmanship which it represents of this gifted writer. This is published by Riverhead Books. And Anne Brashears, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
So tell us, first of all, does this novel spring out of your own personal reflections and or embrace of the notion of reincarnation, that we perhaps have had previous lives here on Earth before the one that we are currently enjoying? I mean, what does that notion have to do with you personally, if I may ask?
You know, I wouldn't say it is anything like a religious conviction for me. Or necessarily a kind of a faith or a belief, but it's more kind of an interest, a fascination, almost from a kind of a poetical or storytelling perspective. I mean, partly I became interested in this because one of my kids, my son Nathaniel, who's now 12, he's the one that I've dedicated this book to. I used to, you know, walk around with him when he was a toddler, and he'd be thinking through all kinds of things, and sometimes he'd say things to me like, you know, when I was alive before, I thought this thing or that thing. I mean, he was quite young. Or when he got a little bit older, he'd say, well, this is my ninth life because I remember being here before. And, you know, I didn't think this is absolutely certainly true and was sort of agog, but it was more, I felt like this was, you know, p- possibly true, potentially true, interesting. I used to like to sort of talk to him about it without scaring him off the subject. But it got me thinking, you know, what if there was a person who could remember, who carried those memories from life to life over hundreds, even thousands of years? You know, how would that be, and how would such a person relate to the world around him? And particularly, you know, could he find someone to love? Would there be many, or could he really find a soulmate? So that's sort of where all this started for me.
Hmm. And I think the amount of reflection you've done is very evident in how this book is written and how this story is told. I mean, clearly you have thought a lot about if such a thing were true, and if, in particular, if someone had, at least to some extent, memory of their previous lives, what would that feel like? What would be kind of neat about that? What would be difficult about that? What would that experience be like for such a person? And it is a fascinating notion, and it enriches the book immeasurably.
It was really, really fun and stimulating for me. And, you know, sometimes you think of an idea or a premise for a novel or for a story, and it sort of wears out after a short while, and you think, okay, well, that one's not really worth pursuing. But this one, as you suggest, I felt like it just kept opening up. It just kept bringing me to more and more ideas, not just about, you know, if we were to live again and again, but about life in general, you know, and the importance of being in the present and the importance of living the life that we have. It was a very, very fun, stimulating book to write, as you say, because they're just, I felt like there were so many things to reflect on and think of and investigate.
Hmm. One of the challenges for you as the writer, and to some extent for us as the readers, is the fact that we kind of veer back and forth between basically the present day and our main character in some of his previous lives, some of which go back to ancient times. And
right.
To me, it's this is one of the trickiest things for any author to accomplish, is to write a story that, in a sense, ricochets back and forth without leaving us dizzy, confused, sort of sick of the whole idea. I mean, somehow you have managed to do this in a way that still feels very cohesive. Can you speak a moment about the challenge of this facet of your novel?
Well, I'm so glad that you found it to be cohesive, because I think you're right that this is a challenge, this sort of structure. At the same time, sometimes I think it can feel sort of freeing to be able to go from one character in one time to another, again, unless it gets too chaotic. But sometimes a book can feel claustrophobic if you feel like you're stuck with one character in one room, you know, on and on and on. Sometimes it's fun to be able to leap around a little bit in history and in different characters' minds. But again, you're right, you do run the risk of it feeling very fragmented. So what I tried to do was basically divide the book between two characters. The first is Daniel, who has the memory, and I wanted him to stay with us in the present, but to tell us stories about his past and the things, you know, the sort of amazing things that have happened to him that he's experienced and that give him, you know, put him in the situation he is today in terms of his enduring love for this young woman and, you know, all the background to that. But I have him tell it as stories, as I don't, it's not flashback precisely. It's more that he says, you know, I want to tell you about my long life. You know, here was the first thing that happened that seemed very consequential. Here was another thing, and here was another thing. So I try and make it very vivid and set it in historical place, but at the same time, be very strongly in his point of view and in his, you know, storytelling hands. And then the other character, who tells this story is this young woman, Lucy, who's, you know, insofar as anyone is ordinary, she's a pretty ordinary young woman. And little does she know that she shares a similar, gigantic, fascinating past. I mean, you know, many paths. You know, she's, you know, it's like the tip of the iceberg is what you see, but it goes down so much deeper. And I like the idea that that applies to most all of us. I mean, our souls, in my idea, our souls kind of start at different times, and some last longer than others. Some, you know, live only a life or two, and others go on and on and on and on. So So Lucy seems ordinary, but at the same time, you know, the principles of reincarnation apply to her as well. She just doesn't remember them.
Right.
But she and Daniel have, you know, have known each other in the past. So, again, she's a more kind of accessible and ordinary character.
Sure. And, of course, Daniel, often we see him as a slightly odd duck out of his element. And it's because, of course, he is this extraordinary person, sometimes in the midst of other ordinary people in very ordinary settings, kind of makes you wonder about the people that are sometimes in our lives who seem a little bit different. Is
right.
this a possibility that this is what has them seeing the world so differently?
Right. Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you know, one of the kind of concepts that I was exploring a little bit as I was trying to open up the world to this idea was, you know, that people who are a little bit odd, who are maybe considered to be, you know, off balance or a little bit crazy, is part of the explanation that they don't have a full memory the way Daniel does, you know, whose memory is very linear and very complete. But are there people who have partial memory, who are remembering bits and pieces here and there and fragments and dreams of old lives? Are they still experiencing, you know, those old emotions and feelings and observations, but just don't know where to put it? So, you know, that was another sort of fun exploration for me.
Absolutely. And at the heart of it is Daniel wrestling with this memory and all of these lives which he has lived and trying to make sense of them. At one point he says, "This is more disorienting than you can know. It's hard enough to maintain your identity through a single life and a single body. Imagine dozens of lives and dozens of bodies and dozens of places among dozens of families, further complicated by dozens of deaths in between. Without my name, my story is no more than a long and haphazard tangle of memories." We find ourselves so intrigued by Daniel and his struggles, not only to maintain identity through all of these lives, but ultimately, of course, to pursue this woman who entrances him so. The book again is My Name is Memory, published by Riverhead Books, yet another fine, fine book from the gifted writer Anne Brushares. Anne Brushares, I thank you for joining me today, and I loved your book.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
And again, that interview first aired back in 2011. There'll be no morning show on Monday because of Memorial Day, but we do want to remind you that you can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast and hear a different morning show interview 7 days a week. So, for instance, this coming weekend, we will be airing via podcast a rebroadcast of my conversation with the author of a book called The Undressed Art, which is a fascinating look at drawing. And the interview includes some feedback from David Holmes, the late David Holmes, who was a beloved member of the art faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, responding both to the book and to the interview. By the way, on Monday for podcast, we will re-air my interview with the author of The Unknowns, which tells the fascinating story of the creation of the Tomb of the Unknown story, of the Unknown Soldier. Next week on The Morning Show on Tuesday, an interview with Nolan Gasser, the musicologist who helped create the Music Genome Project for Spotify, and the author of a book called Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Music. Musical Taste. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock and is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.